It is Friday, the 26th of April, and this is Kathy bringing you readings from the Pantograph for today. Starting with an article on the front page, Pontiac Township class helps family honor Civil War soldier from Pontiac. Basking under a warm spring sun, a slight breeze without a cloud in sight, the descendants of William M. Clark, private in the Union Army, finally got to honor their great-grandfather. Clark, who was born on April 24, 1844, and served in the 14th Illinois Cavalry Battalion Company B from 1863 to 1864, died in 1919 and was buried in an unmarked grave until Thursday, April 25, 2024. This has been such a wonderful day for everybody to take time to do all of this, said Lynn Ingold of Paxton, one of Clark's great-granddaughters. In a ceremony attended by dozens of veterans, family members from across the state, a special group of high schoolers, and even the mayor of Pontiac, Clark received a brand new headstone at Southside Cemetery in Pontiac after 105 years honoring him as a veteran of the Civil War. "We just love it. It's wonderful," she said. Thursday's event was the culmination of genealogical research, cutting through government red tape and calling in a few favors. It started with Charlie Robbins of Champaign, one of Clark's great-grandsons, who was chronicling the family history. Partially because several of the men in his family have served in the military, when Robbins found Clark's name in the family tree, he thought to check the records. "I went to the library and got his obit, and there it said he served in the 14th Illinois U.S. Cavalry," Robbins said. His aunt connected him with the cemetery manager who showed Robbins where the unmarked grave sat. Then the cemetery manager connected Robbins with Paul Ritter. Ritter is a teacher at Pontiac Township High School who teaches a dual credit course on environmental earth sciences in partnership with the Heartland Community College. He takes his students out to the cemetery to learn about the effects of acid rain on gravestones, Ritter said. When they heard about Robbins' project of finding his great-grandfather a headstone, Ritter's class was more than happy to step in. Robbins handed over his research, and the students took the reins from there. Getting a headstone for Clark involved contacting the National Archives and other government agencies to confirm Clark's service and have the stone made, Ritter said. After a setback or two, his students were able to put the marker in the ground Wednesday and organize the ceremony for Thursday, complete with buglers sounding taps, an honor guard made up of local veteran agencies, and a full rifle volley, Ritter said. "I have a high level of pride and excitement in every imaginable emotion of positivity that you could think of is just pouring out of me," Ritter said after the ceremony. Kaya Brogan-Shawback, a 17-year-old junior at PTHS, read Clark's obituary to the crowd, and her classmates handed out flowers to Clark's three great-grandchildren who were in attendance. Her great-grandfather was in the military as well, she said. "Thinking about the fact that he could have been in that situation, being left in an unmarked grave for over a century kind of like really hurts to think about," Brogan-Shawback said. "That made the project that much more meaningful to her," she said. "This project impacted my life in a very positive way, in the fact that I got to help them accomplish their dream of honoring their great-grandfather," she said. Her classmates share that sentiment. "It was very impactful for us," said 16-year-old junior Ryson Oates. Oates and 18-year-old senior Henry Brummel were the students who set the gravestone in the ground on Wednesday. And it was Oates who realized what a timely moment this was. "I just looked at his headstone, and I'm like, oh, it's his birthday. So it was a good birthday present to give," he said. Ritter is adamant that he wants little credit for the marker as possible. "All of that should go to his students," he said. "The reality is I'm nothing more than their chief cheerleader," Ritter said, "and I get to be a part of their team." The efforts of that team left a lasting impact on Clark's descendants. "I am so proud of this. I had no idea this day would come, you know, that we would be celebrating his military service," Robbins said. For Brummel, that kindness and service is second nature for his classmates. "Like our teacher said, do your best to make someone's life better each day. So being able to do that was huge," the PTHS senior said. "And while they learn from Ritter," he said, "their effect on him is just as significant. What they don't know," Ritter said, "because they have a greater impact in me and influence on me than I do on them. Probably I'm a better person before them." And there are many, many photographs that are a part of this. It shows the Pontiac Township junior Sam Murphy sounded taps, a Union soldier who fought in the Civil War and died in 1919. And there's also an honor guard that attended with a rifle salute. Livingston County Honor Guard Stephen Leonard holds a folded flag during a ceremony honoring Private William Clark. And he has the American flag folded up into the triangle and is handing it to someone. And then there are pictures of the Honor Guard shooting their rifles. And Pontiac Mayor Bill Alvey spoke during a ceremony. There's a picture of him. And Pontiac Township High School teacher Paul Ritter, he also spoke at the ceremony. And then there is a lovely picture of the headstone surrounded by red, white, and blue flowers and flags. That's the end of that article. This front page article, Breaking Down Politics at Play in the Bears Deal. As Chicago Bears officials laid out their $4.7 billion plan for a new dome stadium on the city's lakefront, Mayor Brandon Johnson and others cheered as if the NFL's founding franchise had just scored a touchdown. But the team seems to be throwing a Hail Mary pass in Springfield, where state lawmakers and Governor J.B. Pritzker appear unlikely to do the blocking and tackling necessary to muscle through legislation that would unlock the $90 million in public funding the team says is needed for the project. The long-awaited plan, unveiled at a Wednesday press conference at Soldier Field, calls for a $3.2 billion stadium, along with at least $325 million, perhaps as much as $1.5 billion for infrastructure upgrades. The Bears have pledged about $2.3 billion towards stadium construction while asking the state, through the Illinois State Facilities Authority, to issue $900 million in taxpayer-backed bonds to cover the rest. The city and state would also be on the hook for the infrastructure bill. ISA issued bonds, which were used to build Guaranteed Rate Field and renovate Soldier Field, are backed by an existing 2% city hotel tax. Bonds for those earlier projects are set to expire in 2033. The Bears have proposed issuing new bonds to be paid back over a 40-year period. This would require the approval of state lawmakers. This project will result in no new taxes on the residents of Chicago, Johnson said, in backing public funding, proclaiming that the new stadium had the potential to be the crown jewel in the city of Chicago. Bears President Kevin Warren, though conceding that this is not an easy project, said that by working together, the team, city, and state can create win-win-win situations. But 15 miles away from the glitzy rollout event, Pritzker and legislative leaders said they remain unconvinced that the Bears' proposal is a win for taxpayers. I'm highly skeptical of the proposal that's been made, and I believe strongly this is not a high priority for legislators, and certainly not for me, Pritzker told reporters at an unrelated press conference in Maywood to promote his health insurance reform legislation. Pritzker then observed that voters in Kansas City just rejected a referendum that would have authorized public funding for a new Royals ballpark and renovations to Arrowhead Stadium, home of the Super Bowl champion Chiefs. I don't really think that the people of Chicago or across Illinois feel any different than that, Pritzker said, adding that he had not been invited to the Bears announcement. House Speaker Chris Welch, Democrat of Hillside, at the same event said, if he were to put this issue on the board for a vote right now, it would fail, and fail miserably. Senate President Don Harmon, Democrat of Oak Park, said in a statement that he echoed Pritzker's skepticism. Warren, however, said the time is now to get a stadium deal done, insisting that the team will push for a package before lawmakers adjourn their spring session at the end of May and not punt into the fall veto session. He said waiting could cost valuable time, both delaying the stadium's opening date and increasing the overall project cost. Could the Bears come out of the state capitol winners in a few weeks? Sure. Even Welsh, who said it's highly unlikely that the Bears can get the deal they're looking for in this political climate, acknowledged that in Springfield, environments change. But if I were the Bears, I would consider drawing up a new game plan. The same with the White Sox and the Chicago Red Stars and any other Illinois team looking for a public subsidy for a new stadium. As I wrote last month regarding the White Sox's request for a new ballpark, the amount of doubt and distaste for public funding in the capital should not be underestimated and not be overstated, and cannot be overstated. That's true in both the House and the Senate. But look no further than Pritzker. Illinois' billionaire governor has remained consistent in his general opposition to public subsidies for facilities used by privately owned teams and in his skepticism of the projects that have specifically been floated. Of course, politicians can change their minds. Look at Johnson, a former Chicago teachers union organizer, elected with heavy support from progressive grassroots. He opposed subsidies as a candidate last year, but flipped to the point of being part of the Bears rollout announcement on Wednesday. But I'm not sure about Pritzker in this instance. In the 2.5 years since he started to be asked about this topic, there's been little deviation off his general position that despite shifting plans from the Bears and added wrenches like the Sox's trial balloon. For instance, when asked about the possibility of helping to finance a stadium project following the Bears' September 2021 announcement of a purchase agreement for the 326-acre Arlington Park property, Pritzker said that's not something that we're looking at. He was asked again in a gubernatorial debate in October of 2022, his answer even more to the point. Quote, look, I'm a Bears fan. I support the Chicago Bears, but I do not think that the state should be funding the private development of a stadium anywhere in the state. In April 2023, Pritzker told reporters in response to a legislative proposal that would lock in the Bears' property tax rates for the now mothballed Arlington Park development that the state really shouldn't be in the business of providing handouts to private industry, and that's what the Bears are. When the Sox entered the fray earlier this year with a proposal for a publicly financed ballpark in the city's South Loop neighborhood, Pritzker said he started out really reluctant and would be against it unless a case is made that the investment yields a long-term return for the taxpayers, something he said had not yet been displayed. In March, Pritzker said that the Bears' commitment of a $2 billion private money towards the project was a good first step, but alone not enough to warrant state involvement in the project. I want to say one more time, we are prioritizing the use of dollars here for people who need it, Pritzker said. Wealthy owner of sports teams, I respect that they run private businesses and they want them to be profitable and they want constantly to provide better facilities for their customers, but I don't think that should be the highest priority for the state of Illinois. He may say it a little differently each time, but the message has essentially been the same. In this context, it's hard to see Pritzker moving off such a long-held position in the course of just a few weeks. Now there are things the Bears can do to drum up support in the legislature and perhaps turn up pressure on Pritzker and others. The smart play is probably to deploy organized labor to help sell the plan. The unions collectively still have enough clout to make a difference under the Capitol Dome. They will be incentivized by the promise of thousands of stadium construction jobs to help the Bears and perhaps the Sox. But again, if the past is prologue, that will not deter Pritzker from his stance. Kevin Warren and the Bears have 4 weeks to draw up a legislative play in Springfield, but they may need to call in an audible. And this was written by Brendan Moore, so it's sort of like an opinion column. This headline on the front page, 2023, the lowest one-year tally since 1979. U.S. births fell last year. U.S. births fell last year, resuming a long national slide. A little under 3.6 million babies were born in 2023, according to provisional statistics, released Thursday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's about 76,000 fewer than the year before, and the lowest one-year tally since 1979. U.S. births slipped for more than a decade before COVID-19 hit, then dropped 4% from 2019 to 2020. They ticked up for two straight years after that, an increase experts attributed in part to pregnancies that couples put off amid the pandemic's early days. But the 2023 numbers seem to indicate that bump is over, and we're back to the trends we were in before, said Nicholas Mark, a University of Wisconsin researcher who studies how social policy and other factors influence health and fertility. Birth rates have long been falling for teenagers and younger women, but rising for women in their 30s and 40s, a reflection of women pursuing education and careers before trying to start families, experts say. But last year, birth rates fell for all women younger than 40 and were flat for women in their 40s. Mark called the development surprising and said there's some evidence that not just postponement is going on. Rates fell across almost all racial and ethnic groups. The numbers released Thursday are based on more than 99.9% of the birth certificates filed in 2023, but they are provisional, and the final birth count can change as they are finalized. For example, the provisional 2020 U-birth count appeared to show a dip but ended up being higher than 2021's tally when the analysis was completed. There could be an adjustment to the 2023 data, but it won't be enough to erase the sizable decline seen in the provisional numbers, said the CDC's Brady Hamilton, the new report's first author. Experts wondered how births might be affected by the June 2022 U.S. Supreme Court decision that allowed states to ban or restrict abortion. Experts estimate that nearly half of pregnancies are unintended, so limits to abortion access could affect the number of births. The new report indicates that the decision didn't lead to a national increase in births, but the researchers didn't analyze birth trends in individual states or dissect data among all demographic groups. The new data raises the possibility of an impact on teens. The U.S. teen birth rate has been falling for decades, but the decline has been less dramatic in recent years, and the drop seems to have stopped for teen girls ages 15 to 17. That could be Dobbs, said Dr. John Santelli, a Columbia University professor of population, family health, and pediatrics. Or it could be related to changes in sex education or access to contraception, he added. Whatever the case, the flattening of birth rates for high school students is worrisome and indicates that whatever we're doing for kids in middle and high school is faltering, Santelli said. More findings from the report. From 2022 to 23, the provisional number of births fell 5% for American Indian and Alaska Native women, 4% for Black women, 3% for white women, and 2% for Asian American women. Births rose 1% for Hispanic women. The percentage of babies born preterm held about steady. The cesarean section birth rate rose again to 32.4% of births. Some experts worry that C-sections are done more often than medically necessary. The U.S. was once among the only few developed countries with a fertility rate that ensured each generation had enough children to replace itself, about 2.1 kids per woman. But it's been sliding, and in 2023 dropped to about 1.6, the lowest rate on record. I don't know how you have 0.6 of a kid. Surveys suggest many U.S. couples would prefer to have two or more kids, but see housing, job security, and the cost of childcare as significant obstacles to having more children. There's something getting in the way of them being able to achieve those goals, Mark said. And this last article on the front page is not local, but it's about war in Gaza. Hamas offers unlikely truce deal. The group will stop if independent Palestinian state is established. A top Hamas political official told the Associated Press that the Islamic militant group is willing to agree to a truce of 5 years or more with Israel, and that it would lay down its weapons and convert into a political party if an independent political Palestinian state is established along pre-1967 borders. The comments by Khalil al-Haya in an interview Wednesday came amid a stalemate in months of talks for a ceasefire in Gaza. The suggestion that Hamas would disarm appeared to be a significant concession by the militant group officially committed to Israel's destruction. But it's unlikely that Israel would consider such a scenario. It has vowed to crush Hamas following the deadly October 7th attacks that triggered the war, and its current leadership is adamantly opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state on lands that Israel captured in the 1967 Mideast War. Al-Haya, a high-ranking Hamas official who has represented the Palestinian militants in negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage exchange, struck a sometimes defiant and other times conciliatory tone. Speaking to the AP in Istanbul, al-Haya said Hamas wants to join the Palestine Liberation Organization, headed by the rival Fatah faction, to form a unified government for Gaza and the West Bank. He said Hamas would accept the fully sovereign Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and the return of Palestinian refugees in accordance with the international resolutions along Israel's pre-1967 borders. If that happens, he said, the group's military wing would dissolve. All of the experiences of people who fought against occupiers when they became independent and obtained their rights and their state. What have these forces done? They have turned into political parties, and their defending fighting forces have turned into a national army, he said. Over the years, Hamas sometimes moderated its public position with respect to the possibility of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. But its political program still officially, quote, rejects any alternative to the full liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, referring to the area reaching from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, which includes lands that now make up Israel. Al-Hayya did not say whether his apparent embrace of a two-state solution would amount to an end of the Palestinian conflict with Israel or an interim step toward the group's stated goal of destroying Israel. Ophir Falk, a foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, declined to comment on Al-Hayya's comments, dismissing him as a high-ranking terrorist. But he said Hamas has broken a previous truce with its October 7th attack on southern Israel, in which militants killed about 1,200 people, mostly civilians. Militants dragged some 250 hostages into the enclave. Israel's ensuing bombardment and ground offensive had killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children, according to local health authorities, and displaced some 80% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people. Prime Minister Netanyahu's government set a mission to destroy Hamas's military and governing capabilities in Gaza, free the hostages, and ensure that Gaza does not pose a threat to Israel and the rest of the civilized world in the future, he said. Those goals will be achieved. There was no immediate reaction from the PLO or the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority, the internationally recognized self-ruled government that Hamas drove out when it seized Gaza in 2007, a year after winning Palestinian parliamentary elections. After the Hamas takeover of Gaza, the Palestinian Authority was left with administrating semi-autonomous pockets of Israeli-occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Authority hopes to establish an independent state in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, areas captured by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War. While the international community overwhelmingly supports such a two-state solution, Netanyahu's hardline government rejects it. Nearly 7 months into the war in Gaza, ceasefire negotiations have stalled. Israel is now preparing for an offensive in the southern city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have fled to. Israel says it has dismantled most of the initial 24 Hamas battalions since the start of the war, but the four remaining ones are holed up in Rafah. Israel argues that a Rafah offensive is necessary to achieve victory over Hamas. Al-Hayya said such an offensive would not succeed in destroying Hamas. He said contacts between the political leadership outside and military leadership inside Gaza are uninterrupted by the war, and contacts, decisions, and directions are made in consultation between the two groups. Israeli forces have not destroyed more than 20% of Hamas's capabilities, neither human or in the field, he asserted. If they can't finish Hamas off, what is the solution? The solution is to go to consensus. In November, a week-long ceasefire saw the release of more than 100 hostages in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. But talks for a longer-term truce and release of the remaining hostages are now frozen, with each side accusing the other of intransigence. Firefighters extinguish Rivian conveyor equipment fire. The Rivian automotive plant in Normal was evacuated due to a fire late Thursday morning. Normal firefighters were already at the scene for an unrelated incident when the fire broke out on the western side of the building around 11:30 a.m., according to a news release from Matt Swaney, fire inspector and public information officer for the Normal Fire Department. A fire had started under a section of assembly line conveyor equipment, Swaney said. The employees evacuated the plant while firefighters used extinguishers to knock down the fire until additional crews arrived to help. The fire did not involve a vehicle or battery components, he said, and damage was contained to the area where the fire started. One Rivian employee was treated on the scene for minor smoke inhalation but declined transportation to a hospital, Swanee said. He added that because the Rivian facility is so large, it took some time to ventilate smoke from the building, but air quality tests afterward ensured the air was again safe to breathe. The Bloomington Fire Department also assisted at the scene. Rivian employees returned to the building around 1 p.m. The cause of the fire is under investigation, and a damage estimate was not available on Thursday. Fatal forklift accident, Eureka. A Pekin woman has died after an industrial accident Tuesday morning in Goodfield, the coroner said. The Woodfield County Coroner's Office was called at 10:27 a.m. Tuesday to the CNH case International Harvester Factory at 600 East Peoria Street in Goodfield, according to a news release from Coroner Tim Rissman. Upon arrival, they found a woman who had been struck by a forklift, and Lisa M. Hoffman, 40, was pronounced dead at the scene at 11 a.m., Rissman said. An autopsy concluded that Hoffman had died from multiple blunt force trauma, he added. Toxicology tests is pending. The incident remains under investigation by the coroner's office, along with the Woodford County Sheriff's Department and OSHA. Drug delivery. In Bloomington, a Bloomington man faces charges of possession with the intent to deliver methamphetamine. Scott Tuttle, 47, is charged by a McLean County grand jury with one count of unlawful delivery of methamphetamine between 5 and 15 grams, a Class 1 felony, and unlawful possession of between 5 and 15 grams of methamphetamine, a Class 2 felony. Tuttle was released Wednesday with the mandatory conditions of release in order not to possess or consume any alcohol, cannabis, or prescription drugs without a valid prescription. His next court appearance will be a pretrial hearing at 10 a.m. on June 5th. One arrested after active situation. One person is in custody after Normal police responded Thursday morning to reports of an armed individual. About 10:15 a.m., Normal police were dispatched to the 200 block of Susan Drive, where they found a person armed with a knife, according to a statement issued by the department. Officers established a perimeter, and after communicating with the person for more than an hour, officers were able to successfully de-escalate the situation and take custody of the individual without incident, NPD said. Around 11:30 a.m., residents were asked to avoid the area of Susan Drive and Parkway Plaza as police responded to the active situation. That advisory was canceled around 12:30 p.m. NPD said there was no threat to public safety and no one was harmed in the incident. Further information is not available. And in brief, the Village of Downs boil order lifted. The Village of Downs lifted its boil order Wednesday after water was shut off in the downtown area to move a hydrant. For further updates, residents could visit the Village's website at villageofdowns.org. Host Mental Health Panel May 6th. Carl Behavioral Health will host a free event, Community Conversation on Mental Health, from noon to 1 p.m. Monday, May 6th. The event will be held at the Center for Natural Science Building at Illinois Wesleyan University, 201 East Beecher Street, Bloomington. Light refreshments will be offered during the event. Attendees will hear from a panel of medical experts, including Dr. Rachel Immon, psychiatrist, Dr. Burgundy Johnson, child adolescent psychiatrist, and Dr. Alyssa Wood, child adolescent psychiatrist. The panel will discuss the complexities and challenges of mental health issues. Attendees will have the opportunity to ask questions and engage in conversations throughout the discussion. Parking will be available in the lot across from the center at the corner of East and Beecher Streets. Advance registration is required for the event. Bloomington artist publishes novel. Release party planned next week. Herb Eaton of Eaton Studio Gallery, 411 North Center Street, has published a novel titled Yorick's Tent and will celebrate with a release party and booking signing next week. The release party will be held at the gallery from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, May 1st. The celebration will continue from 4 to 8 p.m. during the first Friday of May 3rd, and from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, May 4th, during the Route 66 Red Carpet Corridor Festival. The book focuses on the Shakespeare character of Yorick, who is Hamlet's jester, and how his story lives on. Signed paperbacks are available at the gallery for $15. Cash or check are preferred. The book can also be purchased at Amazon.com in paperback and for Kindle. Eaton writes poetry and other prose for his art and previously published a work titled The Princess and the Tadpole. And that's about all we have time for today. Stay tuned. In 2 minutes, we'll be back with the second half of the Pantograph.